Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and to give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 08-7092, Verizon Washington, D.C., Inc. versus Communications Workers of America, AFL-CIO, as designated agent and representative for Local 2336, appellant. Mr. Koslow for the appellant, Ms. Boras for the appellee.
Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court. The contract provision at issue in this case has been in the parties' collective bargaining agreements going back to the 1980s, and for good reason, because the industry we're dealing with, telecommunications, is one that's impacted a good deal by technological change, and this provision enables the company to make changes mid-term, mid-contract term in jobs, create new jobs, and provides a mechanism whereby the parties can establish an appropriate wage rate for those changed or new jobs. Now, in this case, the district court, in vacating the arbitrator's award, imposed an interpretation on this long-serving agreement that effectively emasculates its value. I'll get to that. But first, though, I want to point out the salient features of the article for purposes of this appeal. First and foremost, the article makes it mandatory for the company to provide written notice to the union when it decides to create a new job or restructure an existing job, and it must do this before it staffs the position.
Could I ask a threshold question, and I'll ask counsel for the other side as
Certainly.
Well, about our jurisdiction. This complaint was filed pursuant to Section 301.
That's true.
Of the Labor Management Relations Act. And in terms of determining our jurisdiction, there's been a lot of discussion about the Federal Arbitration Act provision. How is it that that statute applies to this case?
Well, that statute applies generally to labor arbitration awards and establishes the appellate court's jurisdiction in the case of any district court decision that modifies or vacates or sets aside an arbitration award.
Do you know of any case where that act has been applied where the complaint has not been filed under that statute?
I can't say that I do.
So how do we get to apply that statute?
Well, I think it's a jurisdictional statute, and it's one that the court can take cognizance of for purposes of its jurisdiction, whether it's ever been cited or relied upon, as would be the case in any of any jurisdictional provision. In this case, it's clear that the district courts, I think the both parties agree on this. The district court's decision finally resolved the issue of the retroactivity provision and its meaning, and there's really nothing more for an arbitrator to do in terms of setting the stage for this court's review.
If I could go back to my point, I just
yes,
want to
sir.
Be clear. This court, when it's had a 301 case, has applied our view that where an arbitrator remands, other than for a ministerial task, there is no final order and we lack jurisdiction. Now here, the remand doesn't say to the arbitrator, amend your order to put in 150 days. It just remands it for the arbitrator to interpret the contract in accordance with the party's collective bargaining agreement.
And consistent with the decision of the court, which was that the application retroactive of a determined wage rate may not exceed 150 days from the determination of that wage, which is the issue before this court, and it's as final as any decision could be. There's nothing the arbitrator could do to comply with that decision.
So in your view, the arbitrator could not look at the contract and make the argument basically that you make in your reply brief as to how to interpret?
That's how I read the district court's decision, that the district court has taken that option off the table.
Okay. Can I ask you just one factual matter, and that is, did these employees continue to do these extra functions up until the second arbitrator's award?
That's a very good question, Judge Henderson. What transpired in this case, and it's clear in the first arbitration, is that around 1997, the supervisor of these employees began to delegate certain
right.
functions, but it was ad hoc.
Right.
And it took several years before it became permanent. It's not clear in the record when that was, except that we know by December of 2001, when the union filed its grievance, it had become permanent by that point.
The additional duties
that
they were no longer being paid.
They were no longer being paid. So their job by December 2001 was restructured. And coming back to the features, one, I said that the notice requirement is mandatory. Two, that it must be given before the positions are staffed. And three, the 150-day timeline in the article pivots off and relates back to that notice. The retroactivity limitation, the 150 days, corresponds to the 150-day timeline. Now, in this case, it's undisputed that the company never gave the notice, and that for 5 years after the union filed its grievance in December of 2001, the company refused to provide notice or go through the Article 16B process with respect to these employees.
Well, do you read the first arbitrator's decision as telling the parties to proceed under Article 16B?
Yes. In 2006, Arbitrator McKenzie directed the parties to do that. She found that the company had breached its duty under the agreement to provide notice and go through the process.
So the second arbitrator was then looking at Article 16B.
The second arbitrator was looking at the wage determination because the parties were unable to negotiate a new wage. So the issue of the appropriate wage was remitted to a new arbitrator. Now,
but now, a lot of this delay, I mean, the grievance was July 28th of 03, and then it takes another 2.5 years to get through arbitration.
Yes, the grievance was December of 01. And
I know, but the grievance for arbitration, the request for arbitration, I realize.
Yes, the date I had, the company did not agree to submit this to an arbitrator until August 30, 04. I point something out, and I don't make any apologies for this. This contract covers 500 locations and 15,000 employees. The grievances that get submitted to arbitration pile up at the national level. Verizon uses outside counsel. There's always a scheduling issue. So some of this delay was inherent in this grievance process.
Well, certainly from August 04 until February 6, that can't be put at Verizon's feet because that's the whole arbitration period. I mean, if you said in August of 04 is when the company responded to the grievance for arbitration.
Well, the company gave the union its final answer on the 01 grievance in July of 03. And then in August of 04, they actually agreed to submit it to arbitration. But remember, all the way through until 06, when arbitrator McKenzie issued her award, the company was still saying, not applicable, we don't have any duty, we don't have to give you notice, so on. It was only after arbitrator McKenzie ordered the company to give notice and go through the process that occurred. So that five-year period is entirely on the company's back. Only the company can give this notice. And the process cannot be undertaken without the company's cooperation and participation. That's absolutely clear.
Some of the delays you talk about that are inherent in the process are probably what motivates, at least in part, the limitation on awards being retroactive more than 150 days.
Well, perhaps. And since you raise that point.
And that's really the key question here, right, is whether the arbitrator was interpreting the contract or dispensing its own brand of industrial justice, right?
Right, Judge. Since you've raised the question, and my time is starting to run out, I'm going to jump to what I think is the heart of this and what divides the district court and the arbitrator's decision. And it's this question. In agreeing to this retroactivity provision, did the union assume the risk of the company's material breach? Now, say that in very stark terms because you have to think about this. Because in hundreds of cases, hundreds of court cases, and I'll just read what one court said, but you can find this in hundreds of cases. In every contract, there is an implied covenant that neither party shall do anything which will have the effect of destroying or injuring the right of the other party to receive the fruits of the contract, which means that in every contract, there exists an implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing. The real question is, did the union waive that presumption by agreeing?
Is there any way a party, an employer in an agreement could make a deadline really be a deadline?
Well,
or a time limit really be a time limit?
Of course.
How?
Well, we're not, what we're talking about is not whether the timeline is emphatic enough. We're talking about whether the timeline and the agreement to it encompasses a situation where the company breaches its duty and makes achieving the result determined
almost
by impossible.
Almost by definition, because the award's going against the employer, it will have done something that resulted in an award. And the question is whether the retroactive effect can be more than 150 days, right?
No, I think that those are two different questions. The process doesn't presume the company's done anything wrong. This is the 150 days is not damages. The 150 days corresponds with the time period that the process is supposed to take. Now, frequently, arbitrators don't issue their decisions within the time period that the parties hope. In that case, the time period which would apply. Often, the parties are unable to agree on hearing dates within the time period. Well, the time period would apply. But we're dealing with a unique situation where the company has committed a material breach, making it impossible. And the question is, what would this have to say? What would the contract have to say for it to be clear that the union assumed, by the way, in my 40 years as a lawyer, I've never seen a contract where a party assumed the risk of the other party's material breach. I don't know anybody that does. What would it have to say? It would have to say something like a liquidated damages provision. It would have to say, if there's a breach, this is all you get.
Well, that's kind of what it says.
Oh, it's not a liquidated damages. First of all, you don't get damages in arbitration anyway.
I know, analogy.
This is clearly not liquidated damages because it's not in any way related to the impact of the breach. But what I'm trying to say, and I think it's key here, is that if one were to interpret this provision that's been around so long and served the party so well in a way that creates this incentive for the company to commit a material breach. Remember, in this case, these employees worked in this job that they should have been paid the higher rate for over 2,000 days, and under the district court's decision, they get less than 10% paid. Now, who in their right mind would agree to that? Obviously, something's wrong, and what is wrong is that the district court failed to consider the implications of its view of this contract and of seeing this clause as something isolated from the other provisions.
The arbitrator's decision seems to say on its face, well, there's this provision, this 150-day provision, which is clear, seems clear, but it would shock the sensibilities of any reasonable person to apply it as written.
Yes, and
that doesn't seem like interpreting the contract.
But that seems to be
particularly when he uses the word admonition to describe language that says, and under in no event does it go beyond or back more than 150 days. I mean, that's a lot more than an admonition.
Well, we're not disputing that. The question is, would we infer from that that the union is giving the company a blank check to breach this agreement. What sense would that make? How would this agreement work if all the incentives are for the company to delay as long as possible compliance, perhaps never comply? And so years go by, and there's no determination that finally, after going through an arbitration to get the company to comply, there's a determination that employees get a pittance instead of the having the wage determination made in that 150 days from the notice. And the notice, remember, this is the key, the notice has to be given before the job staffed, before.
But I mean, the union can always say, we're not going to agree to a 150-day cutoff. I mean, you make it sound as if this contract, the union can't say, we're going to negotiate. You know, it's going to take sometimes years to get through these grievances and arbitrations. We're not going to stick with 150.
Indeed, they did. But let's imagine what we're saying here is the company says to the union, you agree to 150 days, even if we breach our agreement, even if we don't give you notice, even if we deliberately delay this thing for years, you're agreeing to, who would accept that?
It says in no event they accept it.
But the question is that sufficient? If this were a court case, I submit to you, Judge, if this were a court case and a contract case, the court would have no problem saying that is not sufficient language to overcome the presumption, the law's presumption, that each party will not act in a way to deny the other party the fruits of his contract. That's too much jurisprudence on this. And all what this arbitrator said, he brought into play the very
same. The arbitrator didn't cite jurisprudence.
He didn't. But he
just
said
the sensibilities of any reasonable person.
He said, in effect, it would be shockingly unreasonable to interpret this contract to reward the company for willfully and deliberately, and I'm not saying maliciously, we're not talking about malice, intent, just intentionally delaying and avoiding and not complying so that the 150-day time period from notice that was supposed to encompass this stretched out to 5 years.
All right. Thank you.
May it please the court, Julie Bross, counsel for Verizon Washington, D.C., Inc. I would like to jump directly to counsel's question that he asked numerous times about this particular language. And what is it that a contract provision could state in order for this time limit to apply? And I submit that the plain language of this agreement is crystal clear and categorical, and it is precisely this provision as the parties negotiated. The 150-day limit is prefaced by clear and unequivocal language in no event. This court in the District Realty Title Insurance case versus Ensman case that we cite in our briefs construed very similar language in the context of a settlement agreement for no reason, and concluded that that language was susceptible of one interpretation, and that was for when the settlement did not occur for any reason, the escrow funds should go to the financial backer.
The problem you have, of course, is that even a botched interpretation by an arbitrator is not a sufficient ground for a court to vacate an arbitration award.
Well, that's correct, Your Honor, if it's a misinterpretation. But the law is very clear, and the standards are well briefed in both of our briefs. But we are well aware of the standards that give deference to arbitral awards. But the cases are very clear, flowing from MISCO and down through the courts of appeals, that an arbitrator does not have authority to ignore the plain language of the agreement.
Yeah, I noticed you cited that from MISCO, but then you don't cite what MISCO goes on to say right after that. But the parties, having authorized the arbitrator to give meaning to the language of the agreement, a court should not reject an award on the ground that the arbitrator misread the contract.
Well,
and then MISCO goes on to say, as long as the arbitrator is even arguably construing or applying the contract and acting within the scope of his authority, that's the end of the inquiry. That's
right. Those are very harsh standards. I grant you that. But there are rare cases, and the courts recognize that there are rare cases of arbitral abuses of authority that warrant judicial intervention. And this is one of those cases. This particular arbitrator stated, as Judge Henderson pointed out, prefaced his discussion of the dispositive language by calling it an admonition, first of all. And then he stated it, to be sure, but then simply said to apply it would shock the sensibility of any reasonable person. He never construed what no event meant. He never reconciled that language with any other aspect of the relevant provision. He simply said, in effect, it's harsh and I'm not going to apply it. That constitutes the type of rare case when an arbitrator may be mindful of the express language, but he purposely disregards it to impose his own notions of right and wrong or his own brand of industrial justice.
There are a lot of contract doctrines, though, that depart, whether rightly or wrongly, but depart from what would seem to be the plain meaning of the contractual terms.
I mean, there certainly are situations where you can imply conditions or infer various things, but every single one of the cases states categorically that you can't change the plain language. The only possible...
Every single one of the contract... I mean, there are a lot of contract cases that seem to depart from what I would consider to be the plain language.
Well, the effect of what the arbitrator did here was to write out this express provision. And if I can direct you to the actual framework, Mr. Koslow said repeatedly, referenced repeatedly the framework of this agreement that made somehow plausible this 150-day limit. But if you contrast subsection D in section 1, which is the provision that talks about, let's see, in the joint appendix, if I could just direct you to joint appendix 17. That particular provision talks about the implementation of agreed upon wage rates and schedules and states that they shall be retroactive to the date the change or new job was implemented.
Yeah,
that provision.
I completely grant you that the arbitrator, in my judgment, speaking just for myself, misread the contract. But that's not really the issue for us, right?
Well, I would respectfully submit he didn't simply misread it. He read out this language. There's no way that you can.
Two ways of saying the same thing, but. Are you drawing a distinction between an arbitrator's power with respect to remedies as opposed to finding a violation in the first place?
It seems
like the Supreme Court and this court in the InBank and the Madison Hotel case has been very strong, and there are other courts that are not as strong, but we follow what the Supreme Court said, very strong on deference to arbitration awards, even when they completely mess it up.
Right. I agree there is significant deference, but even those cases recognize that an arbitrator's discretion is not unfettered. There are cases, and they are extremely rare, the Bruno's case that we cite is not in this circuit, to be sure, but an arbitrator, even in the case of a remedy, can't impose a remedy that directly contradicts the language of the collective bargaining agreement. And to ignore, to delete, to write out this 150-day limitation is imposing a remedy that is directly contrary to the language of the contract that states very clearly, as in the District Realty case, in no event. It's capable of one interpretation and one interpretation only. And to reach the result simply because he felt it was harsh or unfair is doing far more than simply botching a reading of a contract, I would submit.
Let me ask you this. If he had not, because the cases seem to say if the arbitrator imposes his own brand of industrial justice, if he speaks in terms of fairness and so forth, that means he's gone off the reservation. If he hadn't used these words, this shocks the conscience, and I can't remember what else. I don't know that he used the word fairness, but changing the language to an admonition. If he hadn't had those words in there, would your position be different if he had used the prevention doctrine explicitly?
Well, I'm happy to address how that's inappropriate in this case as well, but if he had used the prevention doctrine explicitly, I would still submit that the fact would remain that in no event language was still in Section F, which is purposely not in Section D. That is a purposeful negotiation by the parties that effectively gives an incentive to the parties to reach agreement in these circumstances. And it recognizes that in cases of arbitration, you know, it can go on forever. I mean, in this case, the arbitrator himself took well over 150 days to render his decision.
Here, the arbitrator doesn't say, I don't care what the contract says. He says, I'm mindful of this provision. And then he says, but the employer breached the very provision it's trying to benefit from. Now, why isn't that contract interpretation as distinct from just saying, I don't care what went on, here's what I think is fair?
Well, I would submit that really isn't the prevention doctrine per se. I mean, I believe that that argument was waived,
well,
which we addressed in our brief. But
that wasn't my question.
Right. But nonetheless, talking about the fact that the company breached, number one, it goes back to the point I just made. He still is not construing, much less applying, the in no event language.
What is he doing? He's saying there is this provision, but it's in the very section that the company was found by the other arbitrator to have breached.
Well, I think Judge Kavanaugh made the point. Contracts presume, you know, in every case, contract interpretation case, that a company loses, presumably it's breached an agreement. I do very strongly disagree with counsel.
No, this provision is not written that way. I mean, I gather the employer disagreed that a new wage rate was required.
That's correct.
All right. So it never invoked this section.
Right. The company made an assessment.
But the first arbitrator found against the employer and said the employer had to comply with 16B. And so the second arbitrator says, all right, looking at 16B, the employer breached it. And therefore, how can he get the benefit of the very provision he's breached?
Well, I would submit that the parties in negotiating these provisions specifically...
No, I'm not asking, as Judge Kavanaugh suggested, it may be a botched interpretation, but doesn't it have some relationship to the party's contract? I mean, he's looking at a breach. He's looking at the actual language of the contract. That's all I'm asking.
He's looking at the fact that the company did not, that may have breached that initial provision, but he is not addressing the in no event language. He makes no effort to reconcile or analyze that language. He states it's an admonition, he's mindful of it, but he thinks it's unfair to apply it.
He doesn't say that. I mean, anyway, let me ask you, how about my jurisdictional question? The complaint was filed pursuant to Section 301, not pursuant to the Federal Arbitration Act. Do you have any case where a court has applied the Federal Arbitration Act, or do you think it's unnecessary to do so here since the remand was only ministerial?
I cannot cite a case where the Federal Arbitration Act is applied in that instance, although 301 is the subject matter jurisdiction, and I believe the FAA is in a subject matter jurisdiction provision.
question is there a final order for this?
Well, the question about whether there is a final order, I would submit that there is. In the Garvey case, the Supreme Court stated that orders vacating, when it's appropriate to vacate an arbitration award, the appropriate remedy is to include a remand, as Judge Friedman did here.
But what the judge said was he didn't say, and I'm remanding this for, I mean, just tell me, the union has said it thinks that the judge took off the table anything other than amending his opinion to say retroactive to 150 days.
I agree with that.
It says the court will remand the case to an arbitrator of the party's choosing so that he or she may decide the issue in a manner consistent with the party's agreement in this opinion. See Grand Rapids.
Right. Well, I think that his opinion is unequivocal that the only appropriate revision of the arbitral order is to be consistent with the express terms of the 150-day limit. And in the Grand Rapids case,
the arbitrator could not do an analysis the way you suggest he should have done if he wanted to come up with a remedy that was not limited by the 150 days.
I agree with that.
I thought your argument was there was no analysis that could avoid the 150 days.
I thought you were talking about just as a procedure. That is our argument. There is no analysis and that the arbitrator could make that renders any interpretation other than in no event will it exceed 150 days.
So that could the district court have just simply inserted 12-1 or 12-31, whatever it is, 2001?
Well, I mean, arguably, he didn't cite the Garvey case, but arguably the appropriate remedy is to have a remand to the arbitrator to do that. In the Grand Rapids Dye case, as many other cases, courts routinely assume that these types of vacating arbitration orders with a remand are immediately appealable and have no discussion. I mean, in that particular case, there was no discussion.
Can I ask you about some language the arbitrator used in that same paragraph in which he says admonition and shock the conscience? He says that, let's see, had Verizon not violated the agreement as found by Arbitrator McKenzie and had it properly notified CWA of the changes in response to the December 2001 grievance, and had the matter been processed and ultimately referred to a neutral third party, which it was anyway, a decision by the neutral third party would have been rendered on or about May 9th, 2002. Which I don't see how that's how that would have been even.
It's not
possible.
Remotely possible.
Yeah,
I mean, it goes back to my point. I don't want to get into a quibbling with his facts because I, you know, would argue those are possibly findings of facts, and you know, we don't want to get into that.
But that's the one rationale for picking this date is that he goes 150 days behind May 2nd of 2002. And the May 9th of 2002, it seems to me, just comes from nowhere.
It's out of thin air. There's no, I would agree, there's no rationally derived solution or framework. You know, these, getting back to my critical point about this no in no event language, and in particular, the juxtaposition between Section D, the agreed upon procedure where they agree to it and there is the retroactive effect back to when the schedule is implemented versus when it's submitted to arbitration. All of that is a purposeful negotiation, and these are just about the most sophisticated negotiators that you could come across who have about a 60-year bargaining history between them, and they knew precisely how to craft a provision that would do what Gerhardt found and the union asked for, and that's not in Section F.
Let me ask you, at JA 66 of the Joint Appendix, the arbitrator, after meticulously going through the positions of the employer and the positions of the positions of the union, says, here are the questions before me. And the third question, he says, is the arbitrator must determine a remedy. This will require the arbitrator to interpret the language of 16B1F, which states in no event. And he said, did the drafters of the agreement intend, as the company contends, you know, the 150 days, or, pursuant to the union's interpretation, that there's another way to look at this language. So doesn't the language later, at JA 83, have to be read in light of that? In other words, the arbitrator has acknowledged up front that he has to interpret this in no event language. And then he comes to interpret it, and he said, here's what would have happened in his view had the company given notice. And since there's been a finding by the other arbitrator that the company violated this provision, I'm interpreting this language as follows. I mean, we have to read the arbitrator's decision as a whole, don't we?
We definitely do. But again, the law is well settled that simply by making noises of interpretation, by stating a provision, doesn't mean that an arbitrator is interpreting it. And it's equally clear that I know the Seventh Circuit case in Ethel says, as we state in our brief, that an arbitrator can't shield from judicial correction outlandish dispositions by invoking these notions of interpretation. I mean, if you look at the remedy provision, the effective date portion of his award, the fact is he states that admonition and then says it would be harsh and unfair to do so.
Harsh and unfair, I think, is
or shock the sensibilities.
On Judge Rogers' question, because the parties wouldn't have intended in no event to mean in no event under the circumstances of this case. At least that's the theory. I'm not saying I buy that, but that's the theory. And isn't that, going back to the Supreme Court's test, arguably construing or applying the contract?
I would respectfully submit not, because there isn't any way to reconcile the result he reached with the in no event language. It really is susceptible
of just
one.
Well, I mean, courts, it's not a plain language in statutory interpretation, constitutional interpretation, contract interpretation is all the time courts will say, well, it says in no event, but the parties couldn't have meant that to apply to this particular case, and there's usually disagreement about that, right? But that's what we do all the time, and that's what the arbitrator was doing here, arguably.
Well, I respectfully submit that that isn't the case. I mean, if you look at the framework of how they set up 16B, again, Section D versus Section F, one example, it's, you know, and also going back to the framework of the very beginning, just one point I hadn't addressed yet, counsel for the union says it was a mandatory provision. We have to remember that it was discretionary to the company to make that determination. And yes, ultimately it was decided that the company made an incorrect determination, but there's no finding of wrongful behavior. There's no finding of bad faith. And in the District Realty case, this very court said that there has to be a finding of wrongfulness in order to apply the prevention doctrine. Granted, the company breached that ultimately, but
wrongfulness. That's what the first arbitrator found.
Well,
found you breached the contract.
I would submit that they found
wrongfulness. It doesn't mean it's malicious or anything like that, but it's just a breach.
Well, then, if that were the case, every time that the company made a determination that an arbitrator disagreed with, this limit wouldn't apply.
That's what you bargained for. You took the risk.
That's not.
You took the risk that an arbitrator might not agree with you.
That isn't what the parties bargained
for
here.
The other argument is you say, well, you have to look at the other provisions of 16B. But doesn't that harm you? Because 16B is only invoked where the employer gives notice. And if the employer thinks he has no obligation to give notice, then 16B doesn't come into play. And it was only after the arbitrator found that it was the controlling language of the party's collective bargaining agreement that 16B came into play.
Well, that's correct. But once 16B comes into play, regardless of how it comes into play,
That's your interpretation. But the arbitrator took a different interpretation. He said it was relevant what happened once you're in 16B. And maybe he was wrong. All right? And that's your argument. He misconstrued that. It is an interpretation of 16B.
Well, I would submit that because there is no way to reach the result that he reached without deleting the in no event language from the collective bargaining agreement.
But counsel, the arbitrator's argument, as I understood it, or his interpretation, is that 16B starts out with notice. And if you give notice, he says, then you get the benefit of the rest of 16B. If you don't give notice, as the arbitrator, interpreting 16B, then you don't get the benefit of the rest of the provision. I mean, that's an interpretation is all I'm suggesting. You say there's no way he could have interpreted that, but...
It is an interpretation that changes the plain language of the agreement. And I would submit that any interpretive tool, whether it be prevention argument, a covenant of good faith and fair dealing, or what have you, an interpretive argument cannot change the plain language of the agreement.
So does that mean courts have de novo review of the plain language of agreements in reviewing arbitrators' awards?
Definitely not. I mean, there still is deference, but there...
Well, what's the deference? You just said if the arbitrator contravenes the plain language, I suppose the court has to make an initial judgment, like Chevron, for example, of whether the language is plain. If the language is plain, then there's no deference at all. Is that your position? It seems to be your position. Absurd position, but it doesn't seem to be reflected in the case law.
I don't see that stated per se in the case law, but effectively, the cases recognize, even MISCO, even though it has the qualifying provision afterwards, recognize that arbitrators, the paramount point to make about arbitration is that their power and authority derives exclusively from the written agreement negotiated by the parties. And they have, based on that power and authority, they cannot alter the written terms. I mean, this contract, like most others, have the boilerplate provision that an arbitrator cannot do that. But it also goes to the very essence of his authority. And he may make, as arbitrator Gerhart did, noises of interpretation. But the fact remains that he cannot ignore the written terms of the agreement.
That's a good argument, but it does sound like de novo. In other words, we look at the language, right? Is the language plain? In no event means in no event. It's plain. Therefore, the arbitrator was wrong.
That is the assessment and analysis that we request here, and we think it's appropriate.
That doesn't seem to be where the Supreme Court is when it says, was the arbitrator even arguably construing or applying the contract? I'm saying the same thing again, but...
Certainly we don't dispute that there is great deference to arbitral awards, but the courts do recognize that there are those rare cases, and there really could not have been a more clear-cut or categorical bargain that the parties could have struck here. And if contract language is to have any meaning at all, it has to be applied as written. And you know, cases are equally clear that if an arbitrator arbitrator has to apply that, even if he believes that the results are harsh or nonsensical. And that doesn't mean that the court is usurping the arbitral function. It just means that it's recognizing that there is a limit to the arbitrator's authority because that authority is derived from the written terms of the agreement.
Can I ask you something following up on something Judge Rogers said? And the arbitrator seemed to be trying to do both things, ignore the plain language, but at the same time come up with some 150-day period. Now, he bought the union's interpretation. In other words, start the clock at December 9th, 2001. What if instead he had said it would shock the conscience of anyone to apply this in any 150-day period? I'm going to go back to the first day they made the employees assume these extra duties without notice, without negotiating, without regard to Article 16. Would your case be stronger? In other words, he is adopting the interpretation of the union by saying the 150 days starts at this date. And if he had said, I'm not going to pay any attention to any 150 days.
I don't really think it would make a tremendous difference. I mean, you know, in the Ethel Corp case, for example, I mean, they recognized, you know, that if there isn't a rationally, you know, that sort of attempts to come up with kind of some framework or whatever is, again, kind of just noises of interpretation. I mean, it doesn't really make a difference whether the arbitrator tried to come up with some framework of some sort. I mean, we submit very clearly that it wasn't a rationally derived framework or solution for some of the points that you made. I mean, arbitrations take far longer than 150 days, and these are all kind of pulled out of thin air. But I don't think it would make a material difference.
Okay. Any more questions? Judge Rogers? All right, thank you. Does Mr. Cozzo have any time left? Okay. Why don't you take a couple minutes? You're out of town, so you can have 2 minutes back.
I just want to stress, and I hope it's clear, because there's been a lot of talk here about it, reading this out of the contract. This arbitrator's decision is very narrow. It deals with a very unique set of circumstances, probably the first time this has ever happened since the 80s when this provision was put in the parties' agreement, and it had to do with the company's breach, its failure to provide the notice, and this very long period of delay. This does not write it out. It certainly wouldn't preclude the company from insisting on this limitation, say, for example, if in the middle of the arbitration the arbitrator died. I've had that happen. And they, you know, went way past 150 days, or for any number of reasons not due to either party's breach of their obligations. So I want to make
it says in no event, though.
It does. And as I said, the question is, does that mean that the union has assumed the risk of a material breach by the company? And that I submit to you that courts were not so fine.
Now, the MISCO case says that the arbitrator has to be even arguably construing or applying the contract and acting within the scope of his authority, a separate prong. And isn't it possible to conclude that when an arbitrator imposes a remedy that violates the plain language of the agreement, that exceeds the scope of the arbitrator's authority?
I'm not sure that that's separate from the first, but I think there have been arbitral awards that have been vacated for that reason. But
right,
this issue of what we're really coming down to, what
right, there's cases out there in other circuits, admittedly, where if you violate the plain language, if the arbitrator violates the plain language of the agreement in imposing a remedy, the arbitrator has exceeded his or her authority.
Yes, and then we keep coming back to this question of what the agreement means. And I think the moment we do that, we're in the zone of deference. This court has said that it's appropriate for an arbitrator to consider the structure of the whole agreement in interpreting the contract. It didn't say only when it's ambiguous. What we all know is that terms may seem clear and unambiguous in isolation, but when you see them in context, they take on a different color.
Let me ask you what I asked your opponent. What if he had not felt confined by the 150 days, the union had taken a different position or said, take it all the way back to the first day we got these additional duties. Would that be enough to say he had exceeded his authority?
If he imposed a remedy that didn't have reference to the 150 days and its relationship to notice, I think the company's argument would be much stronger. But he anchored it in the notice requirement and the 150 days and the company's breach. Those are all appropriate considerations in interpretation.
Let me ask you one. Have you given us an example of, in this case, what would have exceeded his authority?
Well, I suppose it would exceed his. I think you've presented one, and that is, suppose he said, well, I'm going to arbitrarily, because I think it's fair, he wouldn't say
it. He's going to put that in the opinion.
But, you know, if he said, I'm just going to grant these employees this amount of money just because I think they should have it, that I think we'd all say, ooh, that's over the top. But he didn't do that. And I'd like to commend for the court's attention. I'm a particular fan of Judge Posner's. I think it's obvious from the briefing here. This court said the same thing, but I'd like to Judge Posner often has this knack of summing things up in a very pithy way. And here's what he says about the test. And this is in the Ethel case. He says, the reviewing court's function, whether it's a district court or this court, is at an end when it concludes that what the arbitrator did was interpretation of the contract. Two, when in doubt, the court must find that it was interpretation. I have been in many arbitrations where the arbitrators don't issue written decisions at all. No one hires labor arbitrators for their legal acumen. Nobody wants them to perform as judges. We hire them because they've demonstrated a sensitivity to the legitimate needs of employers, unions, and employees in the workplace. They have an understanding of real-world dynamics in the workplace. That's why
I assume the parties would hire them to apply the terms of the agreement that they bargained for.
Well, each side hopes
as opposed to just doing what you said.
Each side hopes to get an arbitrator that they believe in advance will come out their way, but we can't agree on that. We the best we can mutually agree on is an arbitrator in whom we have a confidence in. And so
we have some role to perform, otherwise we wouldn't even be reviewing.
We do. But the Supreme Court said in the Warrior and Gulf case that arbitrators have no obligation whatsoever to the courts to provide written decisions. And if there's ambiguity and uncertainty as to what the arbitrator's rationale, it must be decided in favor of the proper exercise of arbitral authority. We shouldn't try to change labor arbitration. It's probably the best institution that's come out of that field in this country. It's the best source of labor peace that we've ever had. And I think, you know, unions lose half the arbitrations. Very rarely will you see a union seeking to vacate an award.
You've used your time.
Thank you.
We'll take a short recess.